You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Arman Rana.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Isa Yu.
I'm Zachary Tharp.
I'm Serena Zan.
It's Thursday, November 28th. At 5:04 p.m., we are broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hinkaminam-speaking Musqueam peoples.
On today's show, we bring you coverage of the former transit strike that encompassed all of Metro Vancouver.
A feature on why you can't liquefy yourself in British Columbia, a continuation of the Why We March series, and thoughts on the ongoing protests here about Hong Kong, as well as an interview with UBC C350, a climate advocacy group on campus.
But first, a headline.
So this is about partisanship in the legislature. In a surprising break from what is common in our legislative system, various bills in the provincial legislature have passed. And some of the bills were originally proposed by opposition party members. MLA Linda Larson of the BC Liberal Party proposed a bill that would see BC remain on permanent daylight time, which was implemented in the Interpretation Amendment Act. BC Liberal MLA Todd Stone introduced a bill intended to counter youth access to addictive products, which was altered into legislation introducing tighter regulations with higher taxes. And Bill 41, which is designed to bring the laws of the province into alignment with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, was unanimously passed by the legislature.
And last week, we started the Why We March series that covers protests here on campus. We are continuing this piece with an interview with Serena Zhang. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And who is a student on campus who is from the from mainland China, and who agreed to speak with her with us about her views on the subject.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have any questions, Zachary?
Yes. How would you feel about what's going on on campus involving the groups that are pro Hong Kong and pro China?
I think this largely involves a kind of a lack of transparency in terms of the information and the media news for students from both sides, because the news that are covered in Hong Kong and in mainland are very different in terms of the reasons and the causes and the legitimacies behind this movement in Hong Kong. So actually, there isn't supposed to be such a big pro-Hong Kong versus pro-China antagonistic sentiments among especially UBC students who had to pick sides. When I experienced that on the protest happening on November the 1st in front of the UBC student nest, I was asked by an observer to have to pick a side, whether to pro-China or pro-Hong Kong, but then this issue about Hong Kongers' protests is essentially for its own Hong Kong's accountable government rather than Hong Kong's independence from China, which is not really listed in one of the five demands that's requested by the Hong Kong people. So the common ground that they met, that the Hong Kong, pro-Hong Kong or pro-China students might have, is actually to help Hong Kong people to address their demands and demands in terms of having an accountable government. Well, I think another common ground is that most people are feeling that they have the shared concern and condemn towards violent protesters who indiscriminately attack innocent civilians. So I think that's another common ground that we can both reach.
And can you go over the five demands again, if you can, or at least sum them up? I've heard about them, but I'm not 100%.
Now, the five demands have changed gradually from the beginning to nowadays, but I think it includes an independent investigation for police brutality, as well as universal suffrage release the arrested student advocates, among many others. So, but now it's, and also, of course, withdraw the extradition bill, which now has been done. So the five demands have been recently adjusted as well. So we need to keep ourselves updated to the news to see what's been happening. And if you want a little bit more updates on the recent situations about what Hong Kong peoples are, what Hong Kong people actually feel about the protests themselves, then I would suggest looking at the 2019 regional newest Hong Kong election that's happening. This is called the 2019 Hong Kong District Council election. It was held on November 24th for all 18 district councils of Hong Kong. And then this is one of the pre-democracy camps that achieved its biggest landslide victory in the history of Hong Kong, getting control of 17 of the 18 district councils and tripling their seats from around 124 to about 388. So this is a very obvious show of people's opinions and their supports for the protesters, for Hong Kong people to continue fighting for their democracy and an accountable government. So, yeah, that's a recent update on most Hong Kong people's feel of the protest.
And you also spoke with Dr. Leo Shin, the Associate Professor of Chinese History and the Governor of the Hong Kong Studies Initiative at UBC earlier. What did he have to say?
I actually asked the professor more of the profound and multifaceted reasons of why this protest would happen. And then because most people, a lot of the people are concerned about whether this protest is about the economic inequality or among other reasons, and what are the actual reasons behind this protest and why it happened at this time and why it emerged and appeared so radically. And then the protester reminded us that the material reason, even though it's one of the layers of reasons, is not the most important. And the most important reason that we still need to focus on is still more about political and ideological. Since the professor mentioned a poll or a survey conducted by the Chinese University of Hong Kong about Hong Kong people's identification of being Chinese throughout Hong Kong's handing back to China, and their identification does not really have anything to do with the economic fluctuations. So the professor thinks that right now it's really more about democracy or accountable government, more of the political demands that people are making. And so the professor also suggested that one of the important framework sources that we might look at if we want to understand this is the 2015 to 2014 to 15 electoral reform, as well as the umbrella movement afterwards. So we can know why the Hong Kong people are so upset about that electoral reform, which completely just rendered the government rather unaccountable to people's demands. Since that was basically an electoral reform introduced by Beijing to pre-screen 2 to 3 candidates, even if they have gained the majority approval of the Legislative Council, that they can be voted by the regular normal voters. So if they want to gain the popular vote of the Legislative Council, then we can take a look at the seats of Legislative Council now, which is that around 1/3 of the seats are occupied by the business people or tycoons, and those people are most of them are pro-China, even if they don't have a very clear ideological affiliation. They do that for business purposes, for commercial reasons, because having a friendly relationship with the mainland can render them more business profits and benefits. So the Hong Kong regular people feel like they're underrepresented, and even if the democracy, the democratic side basically can have the majority vote most of the time, but the elected chief executive can never be a Democratic Party member since that reform was introduced. So the Hong Kong Hong Kongers felt that they needed to demonstrate for their freedom and democracy.
And coming back to, you know, students on campus, what do you think like the university could do to possibly, you know, say or do to help the situation?
Yeah, I think this is a very good question, and I have been involved in a couple of initiatives on this topic myself. There is one student organization or initiative called Dialogue, and in Chinese it's called Duihua. It's by the Chinese students from Taiwan or mainland or Hong Kong to have discussions about the Chinese politics in general. And I think that's one of the good initiatives for our university students to have, since we are educated and here, and we have our responsibilities to have a better understanding and more objective understanding of what is actually happening among different parts of China. So that could be a good initiative. And myself, I also find Amnesty International or Amnesty UBC to be a good platform for us to engage in such discussions. I've been trying to reach out to Amnesty UBC staff or resources so that we can host a discussion next term about what's actually happening in Hong Kong and to clarify some of the miscommunications between Hong Kong students and mainland students.
And to the average, you know, Vancouverite or someone with no affiliation to the people of Hong Kong or mainland China or the protests or is it the Amnesty UBC that's you've been talking to, like, why is this whole movement and the protests on campus, like, of any importance to them specifically?
I think it is, this is obvious to me that there is a large proportion of Chinese or Hong Kong or Taiwanese immigrants in Vancouver. And since that, all of us are really concerned about what is happening in China or the greater China area, and we have our family ties and affiliations with those with what's happening in the China or Hong Kong or Taiwan. So it is important for us to identify the important causes and the reasons of these political movements without being blinded by our own regional affiliations or sentiments against each other. And this would be unpositive for us to have continued and civilized and better discussions that can push forward our peace and shared progress. I believe that whatever is happening in those regions or in Hong Kong, it is the people's own responsibility and people's own job to address those problems. And it is not the American's job, it is not British's job, it's definitely not also not Canadian's job, but what we can do as overseas citizens of those regions or residents of those regions is to think about, is to put ourselves in a more kind of objective as well as more understanding perspective to talk to each other and share our feelings, experiences, what we have seen from different news sources with each other so that we can form more mutual understanding and to push forward the process of these political negotiations.
Thank you. That was Serena Zhang. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9. I'm Zachary Tharp, and I just spoke with Serena Zhang, who is a student here at UBC as part of the Democracy Watch's newest series, Why We March, which covers ongoing protests here on campus.
The world is a better place because of Kim Kardashian's empire,
Cheetos,
fleece material,
and Discorder. It's a local independent music magazine from CITR.
Which means that we can print whatever we heckin' want.
Album and live show reviews, interviews with artists, and sweet illustrations grace our pages.
And even you, listener, can contribute.
Just visit CITR.ca/discorder/contribute.
You can grab it around town or read it at discorder.ca.
Forever local and forever free.
Redgate Art Society has been the hub of local arts and music in Vancouver since 2012, cultivating space for Vancouver's cultural wildlife in an otherwise barren wasteland.
Redgate is having a fundraiser on November 29th, and you are cordially invited. It's going to be a truly magical night of karaoke and dancing.
This night is also celebrating the launch of the new Redgate membership program. Becoming a member gets you discounts on shows, drinks, and merch, access to a members-only calendar, and more.
If you give a shit about local arts, get yourself down to Redgate on November 29th at 9 p.m.
Bust a move, sing your heart out, and help raise money for simply one of the best places in Vancouver.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
French vanilla.
French vanilla.
French vanilla.
French vanilla.
French vanilla.
MRG Concerts and CITR presents French Vanilla at the Biltmore Cabaret on December 5th. Tickets on sale now at mrgconcerts.com and eventbrite.ca.
All right, you just heard a discussion on Hong Kong. Now we have an in-studio guest, Kate Hutchison, from UBC 350, C350, about UBC's recent decision to divest. Or partially divest, and we'll get into that and what that means. Could you start off by introducing yourself and telling us what UBC C350 does?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for having me. So my name is Kate. I'm a coordinator with UBC C350, which is a student-run community here on campus that organizes for climate justice. And we're actually the organization that started the divestment campaign from fossil fuels 6 years ago. So this feels like a really exciting conclusion to a very long campaign.
Yeah. So your members attended a UBC Board of Governors meeting last Friday and demonstrated outside of it. Like, why were you there?
Yeah. So UBC C350 has been calling for UBC to divest its endowment fund from the fossil fuel industry for the last 6 years. And the fossil fuel divestment campaign is part of a global campaign that's organizing against the fossil fuel industry and especially its influence in our public institutions, because we are in a time of climate crisis. That shouldn't be a surprise to anybody here. And we need to be taking dramatic action now, and we need to be challenging the power of the fossil fuel industry in all of the places where its tendrils have taken hold of our public institutions. So the fossil fuel divestment campaign is a way of challenging the social license of the fossil fuel industry to function. And it's a campaign that's been building a lot of momentum over the last several years. Entire countries like Northern Ireland have divested, cities like London and New York, pension funds and churches and universities all around the world are taking part in this moment. So it's really critical that UBC is also beginning to take those steps, especially because it is a leader in, or it claims at least to be a leader in sustainability and climate action.
Yeah. So what happened? So what you demonstrated and you had these very creative signs that I saw when I was outside. What happened at the actual Board of Governors meeting?
Yeah. So this meeting on Friday, the UBC Board of Governors AREP committee, which is a subcommittee of the Finance Committee, was meeting to talk about expanding its sustainable futures pool, which is a 1% divested pool of UBC's endowment fund, and include within that the Great Trek Endowment, which makes up about 22% of UBC's endowment. It's the portion that comes from land revenue on campus, which is especially interesting because we are on unceded Musqueam land. So the implications of taking revenue from unceded land and using it to support the fossil fuel industry, which is actively violating Indigenous rights, that's a really interesting nuance in this debate. But we were there because after 6 years of student pressure, after a really lively fall in terms of climate action with the climate strike happening in late September, the board has been forced through our organizing and effort to reconsider divestment. So this was their low-hanging fruit when it comes to beginning to move their endowment away from the fossil fuel industry. So last Friday, they were putting a motion forward to divest UBC's Trek endowment. And we showed up because we really wanted to put on the pressure. You know, we are in a moment of climate crisis. 22% is something, but, you know, we are at a university. 22% is still a failing grade. And in this moment when we need our universities, all of our public institutions to be, you know, shifting their full arsenal of resources to resist the fossil fuel industry and the climate crisis, 22% is just not enough. We need full divestment. We need full divestment now. And so we actually saw coming out of that meeting the Board of Governors committing to seek out legal opinions that can enable them to fully divest UBC's endowment fund.
I see. So do you know what is the timeline over which they'll be divesting this? I believe it comes to $380 million into the sustainable future pool.
Yeah, so they'll be considering how they're going to do the transfer throughout the spring, and then they'll be approving the final transfer in April.
I see. So by April it will be transferred, or by April they'll have like a timeline by which they'll...
By April, they'll ask IMED, which is UBC's investment firm, to transfer the money.
Okay, awesome. And so, in the presentation that UBC's 350 made at the meeting, it was argued that low carbon funds are not the solution. Could you talk a little bit about the nuances between what is low carbon funds and the alternative divestment?
Mm-hmm. So this is really interesting because 3 years ago, when UBC first rejected divestment after two student and faculty referendums had voted in favor of it, their alternative was to create a 1% low-carbon fund, which UBC 350 was really central in pushing back against. So low-carbon is a really interesting concept. It only accounts for the upstream emissions of corporations. So a company like Kinder Morgan, which is responsible for moving millions of barrels of oil to market every year, doesn't actually have very high upstream emissions, so it could count as a low-carbon company. So the companies that would be included in a low-carbon fund could range from companies like Kinder Morgan to LNG industries to coal. Many corporations like Chevron and Shell could be considered low carbon. So it's really a hollow term. What we're asking for is for UBC to revoke the social license of fossil fuel industries who have been allowing climate change to continue and actually pouring millions of dollars into a lobby against climate action. We're asking UBC to challenge that industry.
So I was reading some of the notes of the UBC, and they describe the Sustainable Future Pool as a low-carbon fund. Is that the case, or is it actually a real? Like, how do you view it? Do you view it as a genuine divestment when they move it to the Sustainable Future Pool, or do you still believe that it's not going like all the way and they could still end up having that money in these kind of fossil fuel companies?
Thanks for that clarification. So it was a low-carbon fund. UBC 350 members pushed back. Okay. It is now a fully fossil-free fund.
Oh,
so
awesome.
This is full divestment.
Okay. And so also on that topic, you know, when we talk about divestment, what is to stop the university from increasing its exposure of the other 78%? Because that's probably not all invested in fossil fuels, right, that other 78%. So they could increase the exposure of that into make it more invested in fossil fuels. And as a result, their net position with regards to fossil fuels may not change. They just have shown to you that this 22% is not in fossil fuels. Does that make sense? Is that possible? Could they do that?
I guess it's possible, but it's unlikely, just because the university's investments work is that they're spread out through a diversified network of industries, and that doesn't really shift all that much. You know, they just do what the market is telling them to do. They're not interested in pouring more money into fossil fuels to offset. And actually, what we've seen is the low carbon, the sustainable futures pool is performing quite well.
Oh, so, I see. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Is there any timeline over which the universities commit? Like, I understand they're only doing this $380 million right now. Is there any timeline under which they're willing to commit to full divestment? Or that's not even, like, even a long distance, you know, million years from now goal that they have? Is there any timeline that they have for that?
So they actually did that on Friday.
Yeah.
We actually had a really fun creative action at the Board of Governors meeting this past Friday. We set out two runways on fabric leading into the boardroom, and one said climate criminal and one said full divestment now. And every member walking into the room had to pick which side they were going to walk on. And we waved some signs and we led some speeches. And what we're seeing is that the university is really responding to student pressure that's been calling for them to divest for the last 6 years. So several members of the board expressed a desire to seek out legal opinions that would allow them to divest on a similar timeline to transferring the Trek endowment away from fossil fuels. They passed a motion saying that they wanted to bring that to the full board meeting just this past Tuesday. So actually, the wheels are in motion for full divestment.
Oh, really?
And we as a student body are going to continue holding the board to account until we see that that commitment to full divestment turning into something tangible.
What possible legal issues could there be about the university? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, well, the thing about legal opinions is that, you know, the university is going to seek out whatever legal opinion can justify what they already want to do. And kind of hilariously, the legal opinion that told them that they couldn't divest when they first rejected divestment 3 years ago was a legal opinion that they sought out from the law firm of one of their members, which is in Kelowna and which deals with family law.
Oh, I see.
So not really an expert in fiscal responsibility or endowment management.
Yeah.
So what we've seen from the board in the past is that they're seeking out legal opinions that will just fit whatever they want to have happen.
Oh, I see.
But, you know, if the city of New York can divest, UBC can too. There is a mountain of legal evidence that justifies divestment, or else it wouldn't have been able to become a legal, a global movement. So UBC is committing now to seek out those legal opinions that would help it get to full divestment.
I see. That's interesting. So for the action on Friday, you were collaborating with Extinction Rebellion. Mm-hmm. Could you describe what you perceive as the difference in how your two groups approach climate action?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So 350 has been organizing for fossil fuel divestment at UBC for a long time. Extinction Rebellion at UBC has just been emerging this term. And I think their existence here on campus is really a testament to the moment that we're in, that students and young people more broadly are feeling the urgency of climate change and are willing to step up and get organized and get their hands dirty, pushing back against power in all of its forms. Extinction Rebellion has been supporting this campaign, especially, you know, they've got a penchant for direct action and really loud visual actions, which is wonderful. And so this Friday was really a coming together of those two forces.
Yeah, I saw when I was walking around campus, there were all these chalk marks of Extinction Rebellion and Santa, we want divestment for Christmas, and these very kind of humorous chalk marks.
Mm-hmm.
So what goes into the decision when you have these kind of very different strategies? Like, of course, like what goes, and, you know, Extinction Rebellion has done all sorts of things all over the world. What goes into your decision when you decide this is how we collaborate with them? And this is like, even though we may not adopt the same strategies, we have common goals. Like, how do you collaborate, and how do you make the decision to collaborate with different organizations?
Yeah, well, I think with any campaign, there are moments when stepping back and doing relational work and doing research and all of that is really critical. There are also moments when it's really helpful to be loud. And UBC 350 has a long history of getting loud and, you know, shouting at the Board of Governors and doing what needs to be done to get our point across. So it's just finding those moments of alignment. But, you know, I think the power of UBC 350, of the community that we've built, is that we know how and when to escalate, and this term is especially critical that we do that work of rallying students, of showing our Board of Governors that we're not going to be dismissed again.
All right. So to wrap up, aside from the moral argument about, you know, depriving these institutions of the social license, is something you alluded to earlier, which is, you know, given that there's so, you know, the endowment is so important to so many students, faculty, and staff, is there a financial case that you can make that as to why UBC should divest from fossil fuels?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we are going to be taking the kind of action that lines us up with a 1.5 degree world, if we're going to be taking the IPCC report seriously, then that means that we're going to need to be keeping 80% of known and identified fossil fuel reserves in the ground. That means that 80% of the profits that fossil fuel industries are projecting to have are already using to weigh out their stocks is not going to be accessible if we're actually taking the climate crisis seriously. So if we do take real climate action, which I so sincerely hope that we do, the fossil fuel industry is necessarily going to crumble. And if that happens, all of the institutions around the world that are invested in that industry are going to be in big trouble. There's no conceivable place for an industry based on the resources of the 18th century in a climate-safe future. We need to be moving away from the fossil fuel industry now, and the financial case is there as well as the moral one.
Yeah. Thanks so much for making it out in studio today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. Yeah,
awesome. We just heard an interview with Kate Hutchison from UBC C350. Just have a quick ad break, and we'll be back with more local and undercovered news.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiyam Nisiyaya,
and the Skakuya, Talitin, Homasque Mustail. Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Welcome back. If you've just tuned in, you are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. So we were all really relieved that the full system shutdown did not occur this week, and we interviewed TransLink spokesperson Ben Murphy about the deal between Unifor and TransLink.
Let's take a listen.
Hello?
Hey, Armand, Ben here. How are you?
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
That's okay.
Yeah, so to start off, could you share with our listeners who you are and what your role is in TransLink?
My name is Ben Murphy, BENMURPHY spokesperson for TransLink.
You're the spokesperson for TransLink and the Coast Mountain Bus Company, or?
Well, TransLink's the umbrella company. So Coast Mountain Bus Company is a wholly owned subsidiary of TransLink. So they don't have their own sort of external communications area. So we step in and we provide comment on the situation.
Yeah. All right. So could you talk a little bit more about that, like the relationship between TransLink, Coast Mountain Bus Company, and also the provincial government? It's like a crown corporation. Is that correct?
Well, TransLink is governed by the Mayor's Council. So essentially it's a council of mayors within the region. And that is who TransLink is answerable to. And then Coast Mountain Bus Company, CMBC as it's referred, is a wholly owned subsidiary. So it's what we would call an operating company. And so it deals with all the matters with employees, it deals with all the operational aspects of a bus company. And so TransLink more provides strategic direction, oversight, planning, legal services, communication, that sort of element.
All right. So we recently learned that fortunately a deal was reached and the strike was averted. Could you talk a bit more about the current status of the negotiations?
Yeah, so that's right. Last night, late last night at around 12:30, a deal was reached between Unifor and Coast Mountain Bus Company. And that's good news. It's good news for commuters. It's good news for the company, and it's good news for employees as well. Both parties walked away happy and satisfied and very pleased with the offer moving forward. It now goes through what's called a ratification process. So essentially the union goes to their membership and makes sure that the members are happy with the deal. And on Coast Mountain's perspective, it has to go through some formal processes to get sign-off from the board. So there's a few steps still to go, and for that reason we can't yet go into the details surrounding exactly what the arrangement is. But we expect over coming weeks that will be all made public. So it's good news because this brings to an end job action. Obviously, over several weeks now, job action's played a pretty big impact on services within Metro Vancouver, particularly the CBUS, which has seen many cancellations and cancelled sailings. But there's also been some issues with reliability of the bus system as well, particularly when we saw the operator overtime ban put into place on certain days. So it closes a chapter for the company. It's been a fairly difficult time, of course, for everyone. So we're pleased that it's now come to an end and everyone can move forward.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we're waiting until the deal is ratified by both the membership of Unifor, and you said there's also a formal process within TransLink to kind of finalize it. Is there any other general information that you could provide that would be appropriate to share at this point about the deal?
We can't at this point, just because that ratification process does have to go through those formal processes. All we would say is that both parties yesterday came to the table ready to do a deal. And I think both parties were very, very focused on that outcome. Like any negotiation of this size and scope, there's some give and take. And I think we saw that. And so at the end of it, we've come out with a deal at just before 12:30 last night. Now, because it was a fairly late deal, it's meant that there has been some impact to service this morning. Big system like Coast Mountain's bus system, it's not easy to sort of restart. Obviously, everyone was planning for a full shutdown. So there is some lingering issues, but those are being resolved now, and we don't expect that there'll be any ongoing impact this afternoon.
Yeah, all right. So we spoke to Gavin McGarrigle, who was the, I believe, the regional director of Unifor last week. And we also spoke to a lot of students on campus. And there seemed to be a lot of concerns on the working conditions. So what kind of steps is TransLink taking to address these kind of concerns?
The offer and the agreement is to improve wages, working conditions and benefits. And both parties are now satisfied. So I think, of course, throughout this whole period, there has been various concerns raised by the union. But as of last night, both parties came to a deal, and it's a deal that both sides are pleased with.
Yeah. So how did it get to this point? Because it seemed there were a lot of concerns. We spoke in great detail about, you know, the bathroom breaks. So how did it get to this point where the working conditions had deteriorated so much to the point we're talking about these kind of issues?
Well, I think, I mean, a couple of things. There's, we provided the last update to the offer, which was, last week, and this is what we discussed as part of the offer last week, that actually had guaranteed minimum rest times in it for transit operators. It also clarified that they can use the washroom whenever required. So that was part of the offer that had been tabled last week and is on the record. So there had been concerns raised by the union, and obviously now we've come to a deal where everyone's satisfied with the conditions moving forward.
All right. So in a statement earlier this week by TransLink CEO Kevin Desmond, he suggested that there is a trade-off between expanding transit and meeting the union's demands. However, one of the union's concerns is that the lack of service is actually leading to overcrowding and poor working conditions. So in this context, how do you think this deal will impact future expansion, for example, the SkyTrain to UBC?
Yeah, I mean, at this stage, expansion plans that are funded are scheduled to go ahead, so there's no scheduled change to the plans that are on the table. Expansion's important. It's very important for a system like what you see in Metro Vancouver. This region is very reliant on quality transit services, and expansion is a big part of that. TransLink and Coast Mountain Bus Company acknowledge that a lot of our services are overcrowded. There are a lot of people on the buses. If you go in peak periods, especially some of the high frequency routes, there is an overcrowding challenge, and the solution to that is expansion, expanding the system, adding more service hours, growing the network, whether that be SkyTrain buses and new C-Bus. So expansion is a key part of all of this, and that will over time, of course, alleviate some of those issues.
So aside from raising fares, where else could TransLink potentially get additional revenue?
Well, I mean, in terms of revenue, TransLink does get revenue through fares. There's taxation as well, the fuel tax. I mean, there's several sources. Of course, it's not easy to raise revenue for an organisation like TransLink, because we are subsidised, as all public transit agencies are. So, of course, like anything, there's a range of options you could look at, but it's about striking that balance and finding a good mix. And, I'm not sure what else I could really add on to that aside. Those are decisions ultimately for policymakers to make in terms of getting that funding mix right.
I see. And so roughly what is the mix in terms of what percentage does TransLink get from fares and what percentage is subsidies?
I would have to get back. Well, I'd have to get back to you on that. I couldn't say.
Not even a back of the envelope, like just an estimate on that.
Fares, it's just under half, I believe, of the revenue is based on fares. And then there's a range of different taxes which make up the other component.
Okay, so it's about 50-50.
Yeah, roughly. Yeah. I'd have to get you the exact figures to say hand on heart, but it's a mixture.
Yeah. But I think it's good, even if you just give a rough ballpark, it like, helps people to understand really, you know, that this is hugely subsidized by the taxpayer as we speak. And, when a lot of people talk about, you know, this thing, TransLink paying for itself, that's not really the reality we are in right now, where, you know, the fares only account for about half of the revenue.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, public transit is highly subsidised. You do not make money on fares. So the more ridership goes up, that does not mean the organisation makes money. Quite the opposite, actually. So it costs money to provide transit, and especially in the context of expansion and huge capital projects that are needed to move the system forward and to expand into other areas. So it is highly subsidised. That's the model pretty much all over North America for transit agencies, and it doesn't operate at a profit. So it is a common misconception, I think you'd say, that people think, well, if ridership's going up so much, TransLink's profiting or making so much money, but that's actually not the case at all. Yeah, it's the exact opposite.
All right. To finish up, somewhat of a lighter question, given that you are the spokesperson for TransLink, do you know what a NumTut is, and are you one?
I do know, and I am in the group, the Expo Line Memes for Transit-Oriented Teens.
Oh, you see your ELMTUT as well.
Wow. Yes, and I am in the group there. Yeah. I'm not a regular poster, but I do find the memes highly amusing. So, yes, we're very well aware. I know our chief executive is well aware of the ELMTOTs as well, and has mentioned you all on several occasions. So we are paying close attention, and we always appreciate your support.
All right, I myself am not heavily involved. I'm just it's just a recent craze that is sweeping the internet. And I was curious how actual decision makers perceive people. So just for our listeners, NumTuts and ELMTuts, NumTuts is the new urbanist memes for transit-oriented teams, and ELMTUT is Expo Line, similar kind of vein.
Expo Line Memes for Transit-Oriented Teams.
Yeah,
yes.
A similar kind of vein, and they're just groups of young people who are fans of public transport, and so they share memes about how much they appreciate public transit. All right. On that note, thank you so much for your time today, Ben.
Appreciate it.
So we're back. You just heard an interview with TransLink spokesperson Ben Murphy on the recent developments. We also had some interviews with UBC residents about the great transit news. Note that this interview was also recorded yesterday, these series of interviews. Let's take a listen. Yeah, so how did you find out that there wasn't going to be a transit strike today?
My mom just saw in the news. So we were originally, I was going to carpool with a friend, and then we found out that the strike got canceled. So, yeah.
And how did you feel about that?
It was good. I mean, I really didn't want the strike to continue. I wasn't sure it was going to happen. And also finals are next week, so I didn't want that to be an inconvenience. So I'm happy.
How did you find the attendance at your classes? Were a lot of people there, or did a lot of people skip because they thought there was a transit strike happening?
Well, I had a couple of morning classes where there's definitely less people, but I don't really think we had a significant reduction because most of my afternoon classes did have a lot of students later on.
During the strike, did you notice like a big difference in your like day-to-day life commuting?
Not really. I mean, it was just a uniform strike, so I think that definitely it didn't really impact commuters as much. But if it was a total shutdown, that definitely would be bad.
And what were your thoughts on the strike in general? Like, the workers were demanding higher pay and more better working conditions. Did you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, well, I'm a commuter, so as long as the bus drivers are happy, then I'm happy, right? Because I need to get home and get to school.
No, we're good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, yeah, how did you find out that there wasn't going to be a transit strike today?
So I was kind of happy about it just because today we had a presentation and, like, my classmate couldn't make it if there was a strike. So, just happy.
But how did you find out? Like, did you read it on the news? Did you see it?
I guess I was going to stay at my friend's house, and then she told me that there's no strike, so my friend told me about it.
Do you usually commute to school? And if so, how long is your commute?
My commute is usually 50 minutes, but then if I were to walk, then it's about like 1 hour or 2 hours.
So you're planning on walking, or what was your
plan? I was going to stay at my friend's house.
What are your thoughts on the strike in general? Like, the workers were asking for higher pay and better working conditions. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Not really.
Well, during the strike, did you notice any difference in your commute?
Yesterday when I was coming to school, I guess the driver was less professional. because like kind of being rude to the students and asking to get out from the front door instead of like letting people out from the back door. So I thought that's kind of like different from usual, but besides that.
Cool, you gotta go.
Yeah.
Okay, cool, thank you.
So how did you find out that it wasn't gonna be a system shutdown today?
Well, I stayed up pretty late last night until I saw the news. I think it came around like 2 or 3 a.m. this morning. So yeah, that's how I found out.
So you saw it? In the middle of the night?
Yeah, it's exam season, so you gotta stay up late studying and stuff. So yeah, I saw the news.
And how has your life been impacted so far by the strike?
I live pretty nearby campus, so I could walk if possible, but it's good that the buses are running, just so I save more time in the morning.
And how do you feel about the strike not happening? Are you happy, or...?
Well, I'm happy that the transit workers got their deal through, so it's good for them.
Great. Cool, thank you.
How did you find out that there wasn't going to be a transit strike today?
Actually, my mom saw online and she told me this morning. So,
what were your plans if there was going to be a strike?
I was planning on driving today, and then tomorrow I was going to skip class.
Have you noticed like a difference during the transit strike in your like day-to-day commute?
Not really. My lines weren't affected too badly. No.
And what was your impression of the strike on the whole in terms of the workers demanding for better working conditions and higher pay? Do you have any perspective on that?
I think it's reasonable that they get like better breaks and stuff, definitely. That's
anything else? No, we're good, thank you.
Okay.
If the bus comes, you just go.
Okay.
So how did you find out that there wasn't going to be a system shutdown today?
My cousin texted me at 12:30. Like, she's like my roommate, but she texted me and she told me like, hey, the buses are going to be working tomorrow, otherwise I probably wouldn't have looked.
Okay. And what would you have done if there was a system shutdown?
She has her car on campus, so we would have carpooled together with our other roommates, so it wouldn't have been too bad, but we would have been coming like really early to find a parking spot. Yeah.
And how have you found the attendance today, given that there was supposed to be a transit strike? Have you seen a notable drop in attendance?
Not in my lab, because like it's a lab, everyone had to come, but when I got to school and the life building was really, really empty, so I thought it was because of that. Maybe not everyone like saw, or like they just decided they couldn't come anymore because plans changed, but it was like really empty in the life building when I came. Yeah.
And what was your thoughts on the transit strike as a whole, like in terms of the workers demanding higher pay and better working conditions?
I don't know about their pay that much, but I do think they deserve like way better working conditions, because I've seen some pictures of like their break rooms and stuff, and it's a little ridiculous like how small their spaces are. So I think they definitely deserve what they're asking for.
So how did you find out there wasn't going to be a system shutdown today?
My boyfriend texted me.
And how did you feel? Did it change your plans? What were you going to do if there was a strike?
Yeah, it did. It changed my plans for work as well as like my plans for the rest of the week. I plan to just like stay on campus for the most part, but now I can like go do the things I had originally planned doing.
So you're not a student here, or...?
No, I am a student here. I just work in the evenings. So I was going to have to pay a taxi to go to work, and I was going to have to either go a lot earlier or a lot later. But now with transit strike, I can go up there.
Right.
So that would have cost you a lot of money to take a taxi.
Yes, certainly.
And what was your perspective on the transit strike as a whole in terms of the workers demanding higher pay and better working conditions?
I think it's fair if they think they deserve more than they should get more. I wish it was gonna... Well, I'm thankful it's like not affecting us anymore, but at the time before today, I wished it wasn't gonna affect like the rest of the Vancouver metropolitan area, but I kind of understood. Gotta do what you gotta do.
So what was your plan for the transit strike?
So a friend of a family friend lives close to UBC, so now I basically moved all of my stuff to Southlands from North Vancouver because I was worried that there was absolutely no way I was going to get to university, and I have a final test this week, so I really couldn't just abandon coming.
And so how do you feel now that there's no transit shutdown?
I feel like I played myself. I don't know whether or not I should like go back to North Vancouver, since the people I'm staying with right now
their house is super cool and they own a Warhol, so I kind of have to take advantage of the opportunity, don't I?
They own a what?
An Andy Warhol.
Oh my gosh. Oh, wow.
They own a Warhol.
Oh wow. So, what is your thoughts on the Transit Strike as a whole?
Well, because I consider myself like an empath, I think that if people feel the need to strike, feel that there is a reason to strike, then they should go for it. However, I am very inconvenienced by the fact that it's end of term and I'm under a lot of stress, a lot of students are under stress, and on top of that, we have to deal with the fact that we can't get from point A to point B anymore.
Potentially couldn't.
Potentially couldn't. Or at least we're delayed. And, you know, do what you have to do. That's how I think of it, but yeah, it's something that's a little, you know, hard, more stress on top of the stressful life of being a student.
And we're back.
Welcome back. You are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard some interviews from UBC residents that were recorded by me and Armand and edited by Adeline.
Yeah, awesome. So the recent climate strike and push for UBC to divest from fossil fuels both prominently talked about the use of fossil fuels and emissions. One of the areas we don't think about a lot when it comes to fossil fuel emissions is how we dispose of our dead. Emissions from the funeral industry. There were actually more than 10 million kilograms of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from British Columbians cremating their dead in 2017. That's a lot. That's not something to cough at. That's equivalent to more than 2,000 homes' yearly energy usage. Given that BC has a reputation for being a very green province, it's very surprising we don't have a cleaner method of body disposal available. In fact, BC is one of the provinces that doesn't use aquamation, a system of body disposal that uses liquid alkali instead of fossil fuels to decompose the body and has zero emissions. Akshay published a story for the Thunderbird last Thursday, which examines aquamation and the fight for its legalization here in BC. Thanks for being in studio today, Akshay.
Thank you for having me.
So could you start out by telling us what is aquamation? It sounds really scary.
It does sound actually pretty scary. But it's actually, I mean, if you think about it, even cremation is pretty disgusting. So like, I don't really see the major difference. But anyway, so it's basically, so aquamation is essentially the process of dissolving the body using alkali. And it's also called like alkaline hydrolysis or biocremation. And the best analogy I could think of is that if you watch like a cop drama on TV, like a police procedural, like, you know, the morgue that they have, like where he inserts like bodies into a wall. This is a very morbid show now. Just imagine that, but they just use that to use liquid. And basically sodium hydroxide and potassium hydroxide, they're mixed together. Both of them are used in cosmetics. So it's like not like we haven't used these chemicals before. They're mixed with water and that releases a lot of heat and that just melts the body. And the bones and the implants are left behind. And this is actually like an advantage over cremation because those would normally get released into the atmosphere. So that's really good. That's all. That's already, there's no emissions there. So like there's no air emissions at all, as we spoke about. And the implants and pacemakers and everything like that can be donated to hospitals again. So that's really good. And then it's not like the family don't get a memento because the bones are then ground up and put into an urn, just like in cremation. So, you know, it's quite similar in a lot of ways.
Well, that's interesting. So they also get their own memento out of that process. So how safe is the output, I guess, of the liquidized body?
It's actually really safe. I mean, like, you can't drink it, obviously, but it's...
Oh, my God.
It's not that safe. But it contains no DNA or organic matter. So, like, it's not like you're going to be pouring out guts and blood. Like, it all gets dissolved. And, like... It's been described as, I know I said not to drink it earlier, but it's been described as looking like a weak cup of coffee by sources. And it also fits into a teacup. So, and it can be used to fertilize plants. So a lot of like aquamated pets, for example, like people use it to fertilize plants and they kind of see it as like giving back to the earth kind of. But normally it just goes to the water supply. And that also reduces the carbon footprint because, you know, you don't have a lot of things to dispose of. So I talked to Derek Tremblay, and he's a funeral director in Granby, Quebec. He runs Lazure. And he talked about how the treated liquid is safe and how it goes into the water supply.
Let's take a listen.
Now, people have some misunderstanding of what's aquamation, thinking, oh, we're drinking again that water.
Yeah.
And we're saying in Granby you don't, because it goes to the sewers, but it goes to the, usine service des eaux usées.
Processing plant, maybe?
The water is treated. I'm sorry?
Processing plant, maybe?
Yes, processing plant.
Yeah.
And it goes back to the river. So, one, we don't drink that water. Yeah. Two, I always say to people, when they're giving me that argument, I said, well, in Granby, there's like 65,000 people.
Yeah.
These people go to the toilet.
Yeah.
Are you drinking that water?
Not really, no.
And they look at me and they say, no. Exactly the same thing for the aquamation.
Yeah.
We're talking here about one person a day. We're not talking about, because if we're talking about 60,000 people, at least they go to the toilet at least once a day.
Yeah.
So multiply that at least for two, and whatever they're going to put in the toilet. So, no, and the residue of the aquamation has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So that go to the treatment services.
Right.
So that's why, and they're using basically the same chemical products, so it will not affect the environment directly.
And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM.
Yep, and that was Derek from Granby, Quebec. And, you know, he's a very colorful character, and he told us all about how the treated liquid goes into the water supply. And that's just a teaser. In traditional journalistic fashion, we're going to leave it off, and you're going to have to tune in next time, which is not the next Thursday, but the Thursday after that, to hear more about the story. It's quite an interesting story, and it really speaks to how, despite BC having such green credentials, it's not that green, really. So, yeah, tune in then. Thank you so much for listening. And stay tuned next, because it's Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM.
Yeah, it may not be Unceded Airwaves, but there will be a show after us. And that's right, we'll be back 2 weeks from now. So do take a listen. Good night.